Hello and welcome to Essential Dissent, coming to you from the last days of the U.S. Empire. I'm Wilton Vaught, producer of the series. This episode is Celebrating the Revolutionary Contributions of Michael Parenti, a webinar organized by the International Manifesto Group and Critical Theory Workshop. It took place on February 21, 2026. Michael Parenti, who passed away on January 24, 2026 at the age of 92, was a towering figure in Marxist scholarship and activism. Among the topics discussed were Parenti's profound impact on the study of imperialism, war, propaganda, fascism, and the difficulties of socialist construction, as well as his unwavering commitment to the global class struggle. Our first speaker is Ben Norton, editor of the Geopolitical Economy Report. Please note that the views expressed on Essential Dissent are those of the individual speakers and do not necessarily represent my own views or those of this radio station.
Thank you for inviting me. This is an important event for me personally because Parenti was a huge influence on me. And especially, of course, I'll talk about the Parenti-Chomsky divide. That'll be the end of my presentation. And Michael Parenti was a very important figure for me to kind of transition away from when I was very young and I was susceptible to this kind of Chomskyan, ostensibly left-wing critique of imperialism that often falls into the trap of helping imperialism. I think Parenti was one of the best voices in opposing that trap. I was thinking in the past few weeks, after the passing of this legend, I was thinking of what made him so great and why he was, I think, such an important figure. Of course, I think the first and most important aspect is how principled he was, especially to anti-imperialism and defense of actually existing socialism. And the flip side of that is he was always steadfastly opposed to opportunism. This is a point that I'll come back later, which is related to his humility, because we see that many people on the Western left in particular are enticed by the ivory tower and the idea that, you know, if they sacrifice some of their principles, especially consistent anti-imperialism, they can get, you know, a nice comfortable position in a university. And Parenti never had tenure. He refused to sacrifice his principles in order to get this kind of cushy position that we see, especially with a figure like Chomsky. Parenti was also always extremely accessible. And this is, I think, one of the most important things about his books and certainly his articles and speeches. He wrote with extreme clarity, and there's no obscurantism, which is, you know, especially if you read many of the intellectuals of his generation. The peak of his work was in the 80s and 90s and early 2000s. And this is, you know, the peak of postmodernism in Western academia. Negri and Hart, these people, you know, who write about empire as some abstract concept. No, Parenti understood very clearly how you must be concrete and clear. And this relates to another point. He was always deeply engaged with the public as a true public intellectual. His audience was the actual people, average people, not fellow intellectuals. And compare, especially look at like some of the philosophical work of someone like Slavoj Žižek and compare it to Parenti. The clarity of Parenti's writing, compare him to Lacan, someone like that. I mean, it's just night and day. It's clear that so many ostensibly left-wing intellectuals in the West are writing to other intellectuals to show how sophisticated and smart they are. And then this brings us to, I think, the kind of crux of why Parenti was never given tenure and why he was forced to be an independent intellectual and was not financially comfortable. And it's because he always defended actually existing socialism. And for him, the defense of actually existing socialism was more important than becoming a famous intellectual. And he was not obsessed with theoretical purity, which is the obsession of so many people on the Western left. And there was always a deep historical grounding in all of his books and articles. And I write, he put the history back in historical materialism in the sense that you must understand every existing socialist experiment in the very imperfect context of their larger material conditions, which should be uncontroversial given Marx himself famously said, the tradition of all dead generations weighs like a nightmare on the brains of the living. And yet so many people love to criticize Cuba and Nicaragua and Venezuela and China and every other actually existing socialist project for those very imperfect conditions that they're situated in. And then finally, I think something that's always so great about Parenti is the humor that pervades his work. I mean, I've been going back after he passed, rereading some of his books and especially rewatching his lectures. And you know, people would joke that his lectures were like 80% great information, 10% him fighting with the microphone and the sound guy, and 10% jokes. I mean, he was almost kind of a stand-up comedian at some points. He always had a great sense of humor, which was so important, I think, especially thinking about the time where, you know, when he was most active, which was, you know, a very dark time of counter-revolution with the counter-revolutionary movements in the global south, the rise of neoliberalism, the overthrow of the Soviet Union, the, you know, Sandinistas fell out of power in 1990, Cuba entered the special period. I mean, it was a time of extreme counter-revolution, and a lot of left-wing intellectuals, a lot of Marxist intellectuals become liberals and social democrats, and it was a very difficult moment. And Parenti continued holding the torch throughout that very difficult moment. And this brings me back to the kind of most important point that I'll conclude with, which is the principled commitment to anti-imperialism that pervades Parenti's work. And I want to briefly look at the shameful New York Times obituary written this February after Parenti passed. It's titled, "Michael Parenti, Unapologetic Marxist Theorist and Author, Dies at 92. And I think this is the perfect illustration from the Imperial Paper of Record. Of course, the New York Times has supported every imperialist war of aggression, printing lies to justify crimes against humanity. So it's, of course, no surprise to see this, but I think it's a perfect illustration of all the points that I've been discussing, because in this article, they mention some of these people who, you know, have been described as part of the compatible left. This is a term that was used by the CIA, actually, to refer to left-wing intellectuals and activists who took anti-communist positions, or at least anti-imperialist positions. People like Chomsky, who have always been very critical of consistent anti-imperialists and certainly critical of every actually existing socialist government. So I'm going to look at a few quotes from this New York Times article. It described Parenti dismissively as a Marxist political theorist with uncompromising views, which is their way of saying, you know, a dinosaur who, after the Soviet Union was overthrown, he didn't abandon his commitment to Marxism. And they, of course, say in the first line, he was accused of being an apologist for brutal regimes. You know, unlike good left-wing intellectuals like Chomsky and Howard Zinn, who are mentioned in a very favorable light, they note that Parenti's influence fell after the 80s and 90s. His books were read alongside those of Chomsky and Zinn, who were better known and better selling. So, of course, the New York Times, which obediently supports every war, is saying you should support the good left-wing intellectuals like Chomsky, who criticize every actually existing socialist government. It's also interesting to see that they mentioned Bernie Sanders. Of course, Parenti was a longtime friend of Bernie Sanders. They both ran for Congress on third-party tickets from a socialist party, and Parenti obviously lost. And Sanders and Parenti had a falling out after Parenti opposed the U.S.-led NATO imperialist war against Yugoslavia, the Balkanization, dismemberment of Yugoslavia, which Bernie Sanders supported as kind of this compatible left. The New York Times also criticized Parenti, saying that he took positions that few others on the American left would take. Well, actually, many people on the American left did take these positions, but the New York Times is more interested in amplifying the views of the pro-imperialist, or at least anti-imperialist compatible left. They mentioned, for instance, Steven Zunes, who's a great example of this. This is a guy who has always demonized every actually existing socialist government, demonized Cuba, demonized Venezuela, demonized Nicaragua, demonized China. He claimed to oppose the dismemberment of Libya, but he demonized Gaddafi and the Libyan government, demonized the Syrian government. I mean, always playing into the hands of imperialism and helping take the football to the 95-yard line for the imperial war machine. And then they say, well, we're against the bombing, but we support the demonization of every government that's currently being targeted by the empire. And it's quite appropriate The perfect illustration of this compatible left is the New York Times mentions that Stephen Zunes has boasted in the Imperial newspaper of record that he would off Parenti by wearing a t-shirt of solidarity, which was literally funded by the CIA. This is the perfect illustration. This is the compatible left saying, yeah, I'm fine when I'm allying with the CIA against actually existing socialist governments. And then finally, this brings me to the end, which is this dichotomy of Parenti versus Chomsky, which if you follow the discussion about Parenti's passing on social media, this has always come up. And for me, this was very important as well, because when I was young and getting into left-wing politics, I was, you know, very ignorant and susceptible to this kind of narrative of people like Chomsky, the left libertarianism, where you oppose every existing socialist government as authoritarian, but you do criticize the empire. I mean, Chomsky has done important work documenting the crimes of US imperialism, but then he demonizes every existing alternative to imperialism. And then for his entire career, when asked what people should do, Chomsky said, vote for the Democrats. Organize your workplace. I mean, that's obviously a good thing. And then vote for Joe Biden. Vote for Obama. So I think Parenti was always a much better alternative to Chomsky, a much better leader, a much better teacher. And it's not a coincidence that Parenti is not nearly as well known. Parenti was not given a massive platform in mainstream media outlets like Chomsky was. And we now know it's appropriate that we're having this discussion. It's, of course, very unfortunate that Parenti passed, but Chomsky has also really destroyed his reputation to the world. We now see that Chomsky was very close to Jeffrey Epstein. There are many emails, not just a few, many, many, many emails between them. Chomsky giving PR advice to this horrible man, I mean, who was also a CIA asset. Chomsky had just showed how much of an opportunist he was and disgraced his entire career and all the work that he did. And that's why I think it's so appropriate that Chomsky became like the kind of saint of the American left, whereas Parenti was always demonized. One other quick point here before I conclude. The leading author of Manufacturing Consent was Edward Herman, who has been basically entirely erased. When this book is mentioned, it's always almost always mentioned as Chomsky's Manufacturing Consent, erasing the lead author. But even aside from that, objectively, I recently went back and revisited. Inventing Reality is a better model, a better analysis of the corporate media and how it serves the interest of the ruling class. So Parenti was such an important figure for me for getting over, for realizing the kind of role that people like Chomsky have played on the US left as a figure who, yes, criticizes the crimes of the empire, but opposes all the alternatives to capitalism and imperialism. So Parenti for me was a legendary figure, hugely influential on my life. And I feel very privileged to be able to participate in this event today and to honor his legacy.
You're listening to Essential Dissent. This episode is Celebrating the Revolutionary Contributions of Michael Parenti, a webinar organized by the International Manifesto Group and Critical Theory Workshop. It took place on February 21st, 2026. We just heard Ben Norton, editor of the Geopolitical Economy Report. Next up is Corinna Mullen, associate editor of Middle East Critique.
Thank you so much. It's really an honor to be here with such an incredible panel of so many of my intellectual heroes to discuss the life and legacy of another intellectual hero of mine, Michael Parenti, who is a true guerrilla intellectual, to borrow Walter Rodney's phrase. Parenti refused the usual careerist, as we've heard already, bargain of the colonial capitalist academy to water down his ideas, to make them compatible with empire in exchange for prestige and institutional protection. Instead, he chose political and ideological clarity, and he paid the price for it. As his son Christian Parenti recounts in a recent Gray Zone tribute, Parenti was red-baited, blacklisted, and forced into itinerancy, not because he lacked brilliance or productivity. And anyone who goes through his incredible, extensive list of publications knows what a prolific scholar he was, and more so than, of course, 99.9% of tenured academics, for sure, but because he had become politically dangerous. And this is where this concept of the compatible left, which Ben discussed incisively earlier, is so clarifying, and where Michael Parenti stands unmistakably as its antagonist. Gabriel Rockhill, in his new book, Who Paid the Pipers of Western Marxism, helps us name what Parenti's own life and career already demonstrated, that knowledge production and ideological circulation are strategic fronts in class war on a world scale, embedded in what Rockhill calls the imperial superstructure. Academia functions as part of the broader propaganda system, a dense web of institutions, patronage networks, prestige circuits, and ideological gatekeepers that reward critique only when it is sharp in appearance but safe in effect. What gets funded, promoted, and canonized is criticism of capitalism in the abstract, carefully insulated from class struggle, anti-imperialist commitments, and from defending actually existing socialist or anti-systemic projects, as you pointed out, Carlos. Parenti refused that insulation and the marginalization he faced makes visible the very system that Rockhill describes so brilliantly in his book. Of course, Marxists have long understood the centrality of bourgeois propaganda in information warfare. Lenin grasped this with remarkable clarity in Imperialism and the Split in Socialism, where he warned that it is impossible for the bourgeois state to secure the allegiance of the masses without a widely ramified, systematically managed, and well-equipped system of persuasion, as he put it. One built on, quote, flattery, lies, fraud, and the juggling of, quote unquote, fashionable and popular catchwords and the endless promise of reforms and blessings so long as people renounce revolutionary struggle. Michael Parenti's work can be read as a sustained empirical elaboration of that insight, showing how this propaganda system actually functions in everyday political life. Beginning with inventing reality and continuing through make-believe media and later work, Parenti demonstrated that propaganda in the U.S. operates less through crude falsification than through the administration of legitimacy itself, through defining what counts as serious, objective, and reasonable. As Parenti put it succinctly, the media do not simply report on the world. They do not just reflect reality. They help create it. What made Parenti's intervention scandalous was not the claim that media bias exists, something that even mainstream critics occasionally concede, but his insistence that bias is structural. It's embedded in ownership, advertising dependence, elite sourcing, institutional access, and the class power that sets the boundaries of acceptable debate, allowing critical voices to appear only so long as they do not challenge the underlying structures of capitalist and imperialist power. And of course, that's why Parenti feels so urgent now. We're living through a moment when the mythology of the free press and academic freedom looks thinner by the day, and when long canonized public figures are increasingly revealed as entangled in depraved ruling class networks of power and influence. The release of the Epstein files, Ben talked about, has laid bare the occult workings of the Zionist imperialist core deep state, networks that many would have once dismissed as conspiratorial. And yet, even as these revelations have implicated figures often treated as part of the dissenting or critical intelligentsia, including compatible left figures like Noam Chomsky, there has been unsurprisingly little systematic analysis, at least in the mainstream, connecting these exposures to how ruling class power actually operates. Parenti, of course, helps us to understand why such episodes should not be approached as isolated scandals or individual moral failure, but as structural features of capitalism and its ideological order. He gives us the theoretical and ideological tools to understand how the Epstein files offer a rare window into the mechanisms through which opportunism, coercion, and greed are cultivated, rewarded, and leveraged by the bourgeois state, not deviations from capitalist norms, but expressions of them. Parenti's sustained engagement with the question of conspiracy is indispensable for understanding the current conjuncture. Across his books Against Empire, Dirty Truths, America Besieged, and History is Mystery, Parenti argued that the label conspiracy theory functions as a disciplinary weapon. Elites do not rule by accident or coincidence. They coordinate through institutions, shared class interests, and deliberate planning. What is ideological, Parenti reminds us, is not the claim that power conspires, but the insistence that vast systems of domination somehow operate without intention. Seen this way, contemporary revelations about elite networks are not shocking because they involve secrecy. They're shocking because they momentarily puncture the dominant ideological fiction that elites across multiple sectors, politics, finance, real estate, culture, the liberal professions, and even academia, do not constitute a ruling class with shared interests and mutual forms of protection. This is precisely what the compatible left cannot confront. It criticizes power in the abstract while recoiling from analyses that name institutions, coordination, and imperialist interests. And Parenti refused that capability. You see that in his 2012 essay, Iran and Everything Else, which I recently discovered researching for this talk and was struck by how prescient it was as the U.S. ruling class now under Trump once again escalates imperialist aggression and threats of another kinetic war against the state. Parenti dismantles the nuclear weapons scare as a pretext, noting that Iran's real crime is not hypothetical nuclear bombs, but economic nationalism and refusal to submit to imperialist discipline. And he adds unsentimentally that if Iran were ever to seek a nuclear deterrent, it would be entirely understandable, given that the U.S. has never attacked a country that actually possesses nuclear weapons, as cases like North Korea demonstrate. It's a reminder that politically and ideologically solid and courageous work rooted in historical dialectical materialism stands the test of time. Parenti's refusal is also clear in his analysis of the university itself. Parenti's analysis prefigured so much of the critical work on the academy today. He was explicit about the university's structural complicity with state power, capital, and the imperialist national security apparatus. Universities, he insisted, are not democratic spaces. They are corporate institutions governed by boards of trustees representing ruling class interests, unelected, unaccountable, with final authority over budgets, curriculum, and even personnel. This analysis is laid out in Parenti's 1986 lecture, Monopoly Culture and Academic Freedom, delivered at the University of Vermont in Burlington. In it, Parenti discusses the impact of ongoing McCarthyism on the academy, bringing in his own experience of having been fired at UVM, after already facing repression elsewhere, and despite the fact that by every professional measure, teaching, publication, service, he was exemplary. What ultimately triggered his firing from the University of Vermont, of course, was not incompetence. It was his open public opposition to U.S. imperialism, his refusal to perform patriotic rituals he regarded as hypocritical, and his visible support for the Vietnamese liberation struggle, including carrying a National Liberation Front Viet Cong flag in public demonstrations. The Board of Trustees overrode faculty, administrative, and departmental support and labeled this unprofessional conduct. In other words, siding publicly with those resisting U.S. imperialist violence crossed an unforgivable line. And we know that line has not moved. Seen in this light, the repression of campus movements over the past several years, and especially heightened in the context of the genocide in Gaza and resurgent fascism, is not anomalous. It's a textbook example of Parenti's analysis. Universities have collaborated with the police, FBI, wealthy donors, state and federal agencies, Zionist and other right-wing organizations to suppress organizing that exposes their complicity in imperialist war and settler colonial genocide in Palestine and beyond. Students and academic workers challenging investments, research partnerships, and institutional alignment with settler colonialism have been suspended, expelled, arrested, fired, and blacklisted. As Parenti pointed out with such eloquence in this lecture, when students expose university ties to the CIA or complicity in imperialist war, the police arrive on behalf of the trustees, not the students. The state intervenes to protect, he says, class property interests, not free inquiry. Liberal critique is tolerated. Solidarity with resistance is punished. And yet Parenti never stopped insisting on struggle. His pedagogy mattered as much as his theory. Long before podcasts and social media, Parenti made rigorous Marxist analysis accessible through public lectures, now widely circulated online. And of course, not his branding, but his urgent political education designed to inform action. So may we honor Michael Parenti by doing what he did so beautifully, telling the truth, even or especially when it is costly, defending the targets of empire and making our ideas useful for liberation. Thank you so much.
You're listening to Essential Dissent. This episode is Celebrating the Revolutionary Contributions of Michael Parenti, a webinar organized by the International Manifesto Group and Critical Theory Workshop. It took place on February 21st, 2026. Michael Parenti, who passed away on January 24, 2026, at the age of 92, was a towering figure in Marxist scholarship and activism. We just heard Corinna Mullen, associate editor of Middle East Critique. Next up is Gabriel Rockhill, a professor at Villanova University and author of Who Paid the Pipers of Western Marxism.
History is a major site of class struggle. Now that Parenti has officially entered history, it is imperative that we carry his legacy forward by lifting him up as a figure who towers over the compatible left intelligentsia, promoted by the imperial superstructure, as a few other speakers have already mentioned. If it be Noam Chomsky, Slavoj Žižek, Michael Hard, Antonio Negri, or others of their ilk. Michael Parenti was not only one of the greatest thinkers, writers, and educators of his generation, he also maintained the red thread through some of the darkest years of anti-communist revanchism in the belly of the beast. By the red thread, I mean our connection to the wealth of collective, theoretical, and practical knowledge available in the global tradition of dialectical and historical materialism. From a working class background, he quickly matured beyond the progressive liberal framework on offer, which serves to contain the left, through a humble project of self-critique, fueled in part by his direct involvement in the anti-imperialist struggle against the U.S. war on Vietnamese sovereignty. Breaking out of the ideological encasements predominant at the time, including certain tendencies in the new left to supplant class struggle by culture wars, he undertook an expansive project of political education, writing dozens of magisterial works and providing brilliant lectures and interviews. I don't think it is an exaggeration to say that he has been one of the single greatest educational resources of his generation. This is most certainly the case in the belly of the beast, where the intelligentsia's level of political consciousness tends to be significantly limited by imperial indoctrination, but his reach extends around the world. The breadth of Parenti's work needs to be highlighted since he was invested in analysis of the social totality. Some of his best-known work, at least within activist circles, focuses on the real material history of actually existing socialism, which forcefully pushes back against so many of the myths and lies, as in his classic Black Shirts and Reds. His critical diagnoses of what he calls democracy for the few in the United States, and all of his insightful critiques of US-led imperialism, provide some of the best accounts of the settler colony that became the world's leading imperialist power. He also examined in detail some of the major imperialist endeavors and their consequences, as in his major work on the NATO intervention in Yugoslavia and his excellent late essay on Ukraine. These works are not often referenced in academic settings, at least in my experience, but they've had a lasting impact on the broader world. His reach extends well beyond the themes that I've just mentioned, however, since he is also one of the most insightful media critics, and he's published some of the most important works on cultural class struggle, media manipulation, and propaganda. He has also engaged deeply with questions of historical methodology and the political stakes of history, as in History is Mystery, and he even wrote a fascinating history of Caesar and ancient Rome. The breadth of Parenti's engagements is seconded by their depth, and he has proven himself to be one of the most reliable scholars due to his diligent analysis of sources and the rigor of his research. At the same time, he is one of the clearest and most straightforward writers, whose books are capable of reaching and educating a mass audience. There's much more that could be said about his project as a whole, but in the interest of time, I'd simply like to highlight a few more specific aspects of his contributions. The first is that form matters. Above and beyond all of the content that Parenti produced, he also modeled for us modes of political education that truly bring people in. Part of this was surely due to his humility, integrity, and warmth as a person, which clearly comes through in his lectures and interviews. However, he also obviously cultivated his communicative skills as an art form. His prose is poetic without being pretentious. It is straightforward, but never overly simplistic. It brings the reader in and educates them rather than turning them off through unnecessary performances of intellectual superiority. His oral communication provides us with the complete range of human experience, leaving the listener with much more than just the content of what he's teaching. It models for us and makes us feel righteous anger at injustice, the fierce resolve necessary to stand strong against opposition, but also the humility and open-mindedness of someone invested in lifelong learning and who understands that the primary struggle is to change the world and that we have to do this together. His seriousness, though, is always combined with humor, and he can deftly move his audience from anger to laughter, from rage to mirth. He was, in short, a master communicator and a magisterial, as he says himself, raconteur. One of the many themes that I've been impressed by is his diagnosis of what he calls the gangster state, which provides an essential framework for understanding the imperial bourgeois state and elucidating the current conjuncture. Parenti developed this analysis in relation to the debate surrounding the assassination of John F. Kennedy. He rejected the dominant ideological position among major segments of the intelligentsia, including the once towering compatible left figure of Noam Chomsky, which was that it was conspiratorial to undertake a materialist examination of the evidence suggesting that the state narrative regarding the killing was hiding more than it was revealing. Parenti reminded everyone that the idea that groups of people would conspire to advance their own interests is readily admitted for many sectors of society. To take but one example, it was maintained for decades that there was a Judeo-Bolshevik or communist conspiracy to destroy Western civilization, something that is now coming back into vogue, particularly if you listen to Marco Rubio's recent presentation in Munich. The idea that there would be conspiracies in the sense of a group of people conspiring to advance their interests is thus clearly not the problem. The issue is really whether it is acceptable to engage in a materialist analysis of the ruling class and its state managers when they conspire to advance their interests. This is what is verboten. Parenti reminds us, quote, "Often the term conspiracy is applied dismissively whenever one suggests that people who occupy positions of political and economic power are consciously dedicated to advancing their elite interests. Even when they openly profess their designs, there are those who deny that intent is involved." Fearlessly rejecting these external, ideologically motivated limits placed on a materialist analysis of the social totality, Parenti investigated the evidence surrounding the Kennedy assassination and highlighted facts like the following. 80% of scholarly books at the time on the Kennedy assassination attributed it to a conspiracy involving intelligence agencies. 40 people who had information related to the assassination met violent deaths in the wake of the Kennedy assassination. In Hunt versus Liberty Lobby, a U.S. court of law found that, quote, "President Kennedy had indeed been murdered by a conspiracy involving, in part, CIA operatives E. Howard Hunt and Frank Sturgis and FBI informant Jack Ruby," end quote. We can draw one clear lesson from this. Yes, the ruling class and its managers conspire to advance their interests, and they besmirch intellectuals who reveal this fact as psychologically disturbed and quote-unquote conspiratorial in their thinking in an effort to kill the messenger so that the message doesn't get across. In other words, the ruling class and their managers conspire to label as conspiratorial researchers who reveal the material reality of their own conspiratorial activity. Another theme, and I'm arriving at the end of my comments, in Parenti's work that I'd like to emphasize in the current conjuncture is his analysis of media manipulation. He provides one of the most concise and insightful overviews of the propaganda tools used to indoctrinate us. I'd refer everyone, if they haven't read it, to the excellent and very short essay entitled Methods of Media Manipulation that was recollected in Contrary Notions. He highlights there a number of key tactics: suppression by omission, when the media simply leaves out certain fundamental stories; attack and destroy the target as soon as a journalist or an intellectual reveals something important, they try to destroy the messenger, as they did in the case of Gary Webb, who was essential to breaking some of the story of the CIA involvement in trafficking drugs from Latin America through the United States. Labeling, meaning the use of certain terms in order to communicate at an implicit level things that are helpful to the advancement of empire, like the term extraordinary rendition instead of international illegal kidnapping, torture, and often assassination. Taking it as a given, meaning how the media simply accepts certain narratives or certain orientations without even questioning them, which goes hand in hand with what he calls face value transmission, when the press serves as stenographers of power and simply reference things like American interests, the world community, and other such things. Repetition and normalization is, of course, very key, and we're all familiar with that. But also there's the slighting of content, meaning that there's an attempt to superficially reference elements that are at the limits of the dominant spectrum to create the illusion that there's an inclusive kind of balancing of perspectives while ultimately always centering the more conservative-leaning, pro-imperialist, pro-capitalist orientations. as well as follow-up avoidance. So anytime anyone is able to puncture the kind of media complex, they're either cut off, slandered, made secondary, or as we see very clearly in the Epstein revelations, they engage in the project of a limited hangout. They want to make it all about the villainous figure of Epstein and not ask essential questions like, who was Epstein working for and with? What are these people continuing to do? And how did the international pedophilia ring relate to all of the illegal activities they're engaged in with international criminal syndicates, with intelligence networks, with financial interests, and a whole series of other illegal activities on the part of the gangster imperialist states? These are the issues that we need to be pursuing instead of simply taking the limited hangout by the propaganda apparatus and running with it. Much more could be said, but I'd like to conclude by asserting that Parenti has made a fundamental contribution to the international project of liberation. He shall forever rest in power as a source of inspiration, a model of integrity, a magisterial educator, and a humble servant of what we might refer to as the anti-communist cause. Thank you.
You're listening to Essential Dissent. This episode is Celebrating the Revolutionary Contributions of Michael Parenti, a webinar organized by the International Manifesto Group and Critical Theory Workshop. It took place on February 21st, 2026. We just heard Gabriel Rockhill, a professor at Villanova University and author of Who Paid the Pipers of Western Marxism. Next up is Barry Latucci, a professor at the City University of New York.
Unlike Noam, I was not friends with Jeffrey Epstein, but I was very good friends with Michael Parenti. The first thing that we have to say about Michael is that he was America's foremost political scientist. And it's not just because of his books, his articles, speeches, and activism, but because in retrospect, we can truthfully say that his worldview and explanation of the U.S. political system and the U.S. global empire with its junior partners has stood the test of time. And it's the most accurate explanation of the world we have inherited. In fact, the mask of this supposedly benign international rules-based order was ripped off recently even by the Canadian Prime Minister and banker, of all people, Mark Carney, at the World Economic Forum in Davos a few weeks ago, when he declared, quote, "We know that the story of the international rules-based order was partially false, that it was enforced asymmetrically, that it was applied with very varied rigor, depending on the identity of the accused or the victim. But this fiction was useful." Well, of course it was useful, and that's what Michael was explaining to us for the past 60 years, when these lies were held up as sacramental bread to be prayed to. Now everyone admits it's always been a lie. That's great. And so now we can fairly assess the imperialist system for what it is and praise those who have told it like it is. The only problem is that in the meantime, the system has killed millions of people all over the world. And as Bill Blum once put it, killed hope itself in terms of establishing a better human future. Nevertheless, Michael left us with a legacy of writings and speeches against this imperialist system. Michael was born in New York Hospital in 1933, the third oldest hospital in the United States, established in 1771. I was born there 36 years later, and I know that the pediatric ward is located in the overhang over the FDR Highway and along the East River. So I think we can say that Michael was literally born on the banks of the East River. He grew up in the hard streets of the Italian working class enclave in East Harlem. And as was beautifully said earlier, his remarkable memoir of growing up there, Waiting for Yesterday, it will make you laugh and it'll make you cry. It exudes the warmth, the hilarious sense of humor Michael had, and his humanity. It also resonates with New York City kids like myself. Around 1989, I was teaching a course on international relations and was forced to use a textbook by my department chair that offered up the usual shibboleths about U.S. democracy and the altruistic global institutions. Fortunately, Michael had just published The Sword and the Dollar at that time, and it proved to be the perfect antidote to those ideological falsehoods that we were reading in the main textbook. Another indispensable book, of course, that Michael wrote and that I have used over the years is, of course, that textbook, Democracy for the Few. It can't be emphasized enough how this book's class analysis of the American political system is such an eye-opener. It's so well written. I always come back to chapter 4, my favorite chapter in the book, where Michael masterfully explains the U.S. Constitution as a product of the colonial slave-owning and mercantile capitalist class in early America, and how it never had any intention of establishing a democracy. He relies on his use of the Federalist Papers and Charles Beard, and we learn exactly that the capitalist oligarchy that they designed and insist upon is exactly the same one that we've had since 1788. And only through class struggle from below did we salvage the Bill of Rights. I feel that this should really be a required reading in the United States, this particularly chapter 4. My personal relationship with Michael began one night in the 1990s when I cold called him about Yugoslavia. I had never spoken to him before. He told me immediately that he was glad that I had called him because he recognized that Yugoslavia was the next big front in the war against imperialism. Those were his words at the time. A little more than a month after the 78-day bombing of Yugoslavia ended in 1999, Michael and I led a two-week fact-finding mission through the whole of Yugoslavia, witnessing the war crimes committed there by the United States and its NATO partners. Less than a year later, Michael already published his book, To Kill a Nation, a very tightly written, argued treatise, still the best book written on the subject of the destruction of Yugoslavia by the United States and NATO imperialism. In it, he explains the war crimes, the thousands murdered by U.S. and NATO bombings. But he highlights the main point of the imperialist intervention itself. After the collapse of the Berlin Wall and the Soviet Union, there was only one country in Europe left with a socialist system, and that was Yugoslavia. The target of the bombing was not Yugoslavia's military. I'm literally talking about the bombing itself. It was all aimed at destroying the socialized property forms, the working class achievements of the Yugoslav Socialist Revolution. Yugoslav socialism was not the same as Soviet socialism, Chinese socialism, Cuban socialism. But as we say of China, Chinese socialism is written in Chinese characters. So too, we can say that the Yugoslav system of socialism was written in Cyrillic and Latin alphabets of the 28 nationalities that formed the Socialist Federation of Yugoslavia. The first targets of the bombing were the socialist property of the state media, the banks, the trains, the infrastructure, the schools, the car factories, all the achievements of the socialist state. And all while the liberal left was claiming on every platform they had that this was some sort of prison house of peoples under Milosevic's dictatorship, as Amy Goodman repeatedly claimed day after day on her Father Coughlin radio program. Michael never lost an opportunity to crack a joke and once exclaimed as we were walking through Belgrade, "Where are the cops?" I thought this was Milosevic's dictatorship. Well, of course, there were no cops on the street and there was no dictatorship. Yugoslavia had a freer media, a freer culture, and a freer political system than the United States ever had. In Black Shirts and Reds, there is a superb discourse, probably the best I've ever seen, on why those who criticize actually existing socialist systems and revolutions and the achievements are the vilest enemies of the working class and of people in general. Michael loved to talk about how this was how you knew that when the liberal left, when the liberal imperialists genuflect, literally bending on one knee, one of his favorite words, before the imperialist ideology and ruling class, you know when they're attacking the achievements of socialism and of actually existing socialism. Those are the true enemies. Say anything you want, but just make sure you condemn actually existing socialism, socialist system, and revolutions. And then he added in Black Shirts and Reds, touching addition to this, quote, "Some of us from poor families who carry around the hidden injuries of class are much impressed by these achievements and are unwilling to dismiss them as mere economics." I believe that sums up the viewpoint of a true working class socialist revolutionary. He ended Black Shirts and Reds also with a brilliant coda tying together the environmental struggle and the class struggle, noting that if we lose this fight against global capitalism, they may take us all down together with them once and forever, as he put it. No doubt Michael's writings leave us a great legacy, but I will remember the man and my friend who stood up to the lies against Yugoslavia when the entire world was genuflecting in front of the idols of the unipolar empire. As they say, courage is not the absence of fear, but fighting for the truth, even when the world is against you and you have plenty to fear. That's courage. And that combination of courage and genius is what Michael Parenti was all about. Thank you.
You're listening to Essential Dissent. This episode is Celebrating the Revolutionary Contributions of Michael Parenti, a webinar organized by the International Manifesto Group and Critical Theory Workshop. It took place on February 21st, 2026. We just heard Barry Latucci, a professor at the City University of New York. Next up is Sarah Flounders, co-director of the International Action Center.
We may be days, hours against a horrific war on Iran and a far wider war in Asia and a new level of strangulation of Cuba. So it's a crucial time to discuss Michael Parenti in time of war, endless war. And faced with the total violence of an imperialist war, we need action, agitation, and confrontation. And I say that I'm not an academic. I'm an activist, an organizer. And what I most valued, Parenti moved people into action. Michael Parenti spoke to those determined to resist. He was for the picket line, the demonstrations, the takeovers, and the armed struggle. The overwhelming corporate propaganda is designed to marginalize opposition. And the role of Western academics is to cushion vicious reality and create confusion, passivity, stand on the sidelines with petty criticism. Now, I can't duplicate the excellent points of other speakers, but I'll focus on the period when I worked closely with Michael Parenti, that decade of wars on the Yugoslav Federation. I'm glad to be speaking after Barry Latucci. This was a time when there were few allies, and Michael Parenti was combative, unapologetic, and that was so refreshing. He got to the essence, the class truth of the issue. He posed it always as, which side are you on? And Michael Parenti was on the side of the working class, especially when they were under attack. He really saw it, the world in global terms, in a long struggle. And he knew on every issue he was against U.S. imperialism. He proudly took sides. Then he got the facts and the details to back up his position. First, he took a side, and that's why he's really such a winning writer, in my opinion. The U.S. and NATO powers organized with guns, money, tons of propaganda, the breakup of the Socialist Federation of Yugoslavia into a half dozen weak mini-states. Their goal was to assert U.S. military and political dominance in Europe through U.S.-commanded military alliance, NATO, and to violently crush, literally rip apart, the last independent government in Eastern Europe. The propaganda war succeeded, even in confusing most progressives in the West, with well-planned and executed offensive lies that blamed every problem in the Balkans on Serbia and President Milosevic, who was wildly demonized as a fanatic dictator. It was one relentless scenario. So it's essential to remember that period. The 1990s, corporate globalization seemed all-powerful. The collapse of the Soviet Union, all the other socialist countries in Eastern Europe, the catastrophic drop in aid once given to Cuba, the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, and throughout Africa, the years of unrelenting war propaganda created in that time great demoralization and confusion. Now, Yugoslavia was a Clinton-Madeleine Albright Democratic Party war. It's not Bush and the Republicans, as during the Iraq War. And this further silenced any liberal opposition. So I really value those who are willing to jump into a struggle when it's difficult, and those who use their talents to help cut through the layers of wild propaganda. The Balkan Wars began with the U.S.-German recognition of the distinct republics of Yugoslavia as suddenly independent entities under NATO control. And then came the NATO bombing of Bosnia, 22 days to impose the Dayton Accords. In Bosnia, and I was there at that time, they saw the absolute ruin, the resulting dysfunction that the U.S. intentionally created. Always it was Serbia that was to blame. The U.S. role was a peacekeeper. Now, I was in Serbia during the darkest days of the U.S.-NATO bombing in May 1999. It's a delegation. In 78 days, NATO destroyed 14 tanks. Yugoslavia didn't have a large military, but they bombed 480 schools, 33 hospitals, busy marketplaces, churches, bridges, passenger trains, crowded buses, and the electric grid. It was overwhelmingly civilian targets and civilian infrastructure. During the war was followed by Michael Parenti and Barry's trip to Yugoslavia shortly after the war, because we really needed here in the U.S. voices of opposition and of solidarity. We organized together mass U.S. war crimes tribunals, gathering testimony, photos, eyewitness accounts, listing the names of every school and hospital and marketplace that was hit. These were big public events. They're forgotten, even here now. There were hearings throughout Europe and the U.S. I worked with the former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark for years on this campaign. Michael Parenti was an incredibly fast and comprehensive writer and an extraordinary speaker in this time. Within months of his visit to Serbia, he produced To Kill a Nation, The Attack on Yugoslavia. It had my endorsement on the back cover, and it still stands. This is how I still feel about this book. To Kill a Nation is the best explanation of the great crime NATO committed and what it will mean for our future. It's full of insights on the role of U.S. militarism and media disinformation in the service of corporate profit. That's still true. It was our determination that history not be written by the victors. Michael contributed a chapter called The Media and Their Atrocities, and he helped John Catalinato and me and a whole team of activists to conceptualize how to organize this ton of material and graphs and lists and testimony that we had into a book titled Hidden Agenda, The U.S.-NATO Takeover of Yugoslavia. Now, the war didn't end with the bombing and the brutal ceasefire agreement. Serbia was the first of a whole series of U.S.-orchestrated color revolutions. It established the template that was used again and again to overthrow elected governments by creating well-funded chaos in the streets. Milosevic was overthrown. He was jailed in April 2001 and then literally kidnapped to the Hague prison in June of 2001 to stand trial for war crimes committed against his country. All the forces who had opposed the U.S.-NATO war came together to form an international committee to defend Slobodan Milosevic. It was established in Belgrade and Berlin. And again, it took great courage for Michael Parenti to lend his name to this effort. He became the chairman of the U.S. National Section of the International Committee to defend Slobodan Milosevic. Now, today, we're organizing to defend a U.S.-kidnapped, elected president of Venezuela, Nicolas Maduro, and the elected deputy of the National Assembly of Venezuela, Celia Flores. In doing that, we should remember the conduct of the Hague Tribunal. Milosevic was supposedly put on trial at a specially created international tribunal at The Hague, but he was refused a lawyer of his choice. Then he was refused the right to represent himself, and his microphone was simply turned off during major sections of this phony trial. After 5 years, in 2006, he was finally supposed to present his view, but he was medically assassinated. He claimed again and again he was being poisoned, being deprived of proper medications for his chronic heart disease, and we were in the midst of waging an international campaign that he received medical treatment when he died of cardiac arrest. So I want to salute Michael Parenti for standing up to the wall of U.S. propaganda and aggressive military, political, and economic destruction. Today, we're in a very different period. A mere 25, 30 years ago, U.S. domination seemed uncontested. It was the American century. The plan was global domination. And today, it's clear that U.S. power, its infrastructure, and certainly its economy is in decline. That sanctions, tariffs, and war can't reverse their decline. So, in closing, I so recall that Michael stayed firm in his defense of President Milosevic. But even as that was happening, there was another period in history that has his attention. He would talk of it. He would pull up new facts when you're in conversation with him. He had such a wide-ranging historic interest. He was always curious, always class-conscious in an encyclopedic way. His next book was The Assassination of Julius Caesar, A People's History of Ancient Rome. Why? Because the class struggle is the one constant. So let's never leave the writing of history up to the victors. Michael Parenti, presente.
You've been listening to Essential Dissent, and we just heard Sarah Flounders, co-director of the International Action Center. This episode was Celebrating the Revolutionary Contributions of Michael Parenti, a webinar organized by the International Manifesto Group and Critical Theory Workshop. It took place on February 21st, 2026. Michael Parenti, who passed away on January 24th, 2026 at the age of 92, was a towering figure in Marxist scholarship and activism. Among the topics discussed were Parenti's profound impact on the study of imperialism, war, propaganda, fascism, and the difficulties of socialist construction, as well as his unwavering commitment to the global class struggle. Please note that the views expressed on Essential Dissent are those of the individual speakers and do not necessarily represent my own views or those of this radio station. I'm Wilton Vaught, saying thanks for listening, and remember, never believe anything until you hear the official denial.